Hi, this is Anthea Williams. Welcome to the Sideshow Podcast, a show by and for artists with disability. Our first season was made under the title Activated Arts. We've uploaded every episode of the first season, and you can listen to them here at your leisure.
Welcome to Activated Arts on 2RPH. This week, I'm talking all things consultancy with some brilliant artists, producers, and advocates. Tom Middleditch is the artistic director of Atistic. He's a writer, a director, a performer, and a neurodiversity and inclusion consultant. Tom is also the inclusion coordinator for St. Martin's Youth Arts Centre. Tom, thanks so much for joining us on Activated Arts.
Not at all. Thank you for having me on. I hope I live up to that bio that... Did I write that? I keep forgetting when I've written bios and then somebody is saying nice things about me and I'm like, oh, that is pretty nice. And then I wonder if I wrote that, is that ego? Oh, no.
I stole it from various sources.
Borrowed, a good artist.
Exactly. Steal like an artist.
Yes.
Now, I'm right in saying your theatre company is pronounced Atistic?
Yes. Good on getting it right on the first try. A_tistic, because we can't do it without you. And that is the only time that I will bring that pun up, because I seem to get a lot of genuine derision. I mean, of all of the really controversial and intense conversations I've had with artists over neurodiversity and the state of what neurodiversity means in the modern day, that pun seems to get most people the most wound up.
It's mostly pretty hilarious.
It's great. It's so much fun. And I think it's because Atistic as a name is just kind of, it's modern, but it's got a gap. They've got an underscore. What could that mean? And then a dad joke pun is just there.
There on your tip of your tongue. I love it.
Yeah.
Hey, so tell us a little bit about the company. What is it that Atistic does?
Sure. Well, Atistic is a collection of five core artists, and we operate similar to how Monty Python operated, where we all go off and we all do our own independent stuff. We all have our own, as artists of our sort of work, we all have lives and careers that we do and working across multiple industries. But when we come together, our specific interest is increasing the neurodiversity capacity, presence, and vision within the Melbourne and Australian arts scene. So the way we do that is through a number of channels. First is our performance outcomes, where we create a show, we put on the show, and then we have a show. And that's a good process, we've found, to have, the creation of art be part of it. The second thing is that we work in consultancy. So that can range from things such as doing relaxed performance consultancy, which is a majority of the work that I find myself doing these days, to doing consultancy for novels that feature neurodiverse characters, where the author has done research but wants to make sure that there's a sensitivity read there, to consultancy around whether or not a script is using the right terminology or having the right discussions around neurodiversity. And the third avenue we go down is workshop facilitation. We have a wide variety of workshops that we offer, because the idea of how do you increase neurodiverse inclusion and understanding is, dramaturgically, it's a really intense and interesting question. And our workshops tend to be pretty free form, but often we'll have a really, really specific goal with all of them. So, for example, one of the workshops we did was about neurodiverse inclusion within the drama classroom, and that was run in conjunction with Drama Victoria. Another workshop that I do is with Back-to-Back Theatre about inclusive practice, which is entirely focused on how do we include people in this workshop right now, and how do we make the process of that inclusion be the content of the workshop. So the challenge then becomes, how do you make inclusion content? And by doing so, create, groundbreaking stuff. Because if you're including people who haven't been included, by definition, you're doing something that hasn't been done before, hence groundbreaking.
Yeah, awesome. That's a remarkable broad spectrum of works that you're doing for five people. Congratulations. I think that's really, really cool.
Thank you.
Hey, so when we first started talking about you coming on the show, you said to me that you saw relaxed performances as a type of dramaturgy. Can you just tell our audiences, in case they don't know, what a relaxed performance is, and then tell us why that is dramaturgy?
Sure. So a relaxed performance, as it is traditionally understood, is a performance access type where a show is made accessible to autistic children, generally, by having the lights lowered, the sound lowered, the general social permissions of a space eased up, and by creating spaces where autistic sensitivities are able to be de-stressed, so a quiet space within a theatre. Basically, a relaxed performance asks the question, okay, our audience do not all have the same brain type. They do not all have the same neurotype. So their capacity to take in this show right here is not going to be the expected way that we've created it for a neurotypical audience member. So with that in mind, how do we give this audience a similar experience or even the same experience of this art without pushing them into zones that become socially or physically impossible for them to maintain themselves? Mm. Now, one of the changes that I have worked on trying to implement when I do consultation for relaxed performances, there's a couple of things. First, I do adult shows mostly, because obviously autism doesn't end when the funding ends, and you go through your life as a neurodiverse adult, and
absolutely
it'd be good to be able to see some art.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Yeah, so I most of my work has been done with companies like the Malt House and Darabin Arts Center, and the works that I have sought to relax are for a predominantly mature audience. And I lost my spot in my head. Sometimes I'll just trail off. It's the ADHD in me. I'll have a really exciting sentence and then it will run away from me.
You were talking about how you do relaxed performance and you work a lot with the Malt House and you work with Darabin Arts Centre and you work a lot for adult audiences.
Yes. That's in a way why we can think of relaxed performance as dramaturgy. For a start, if you're trying to create a relaxed show for an adult audience member, the one thing you don't want to do is take out all the really intense stuff, because then the message you're sending is, you are a deficit audience, we're going to make a deficit show. You don't deserve to have a show specifically tailored to your phenomenal perceptions.
Yeah, so great.
So we're just going to take things out or not consider it or consider this an imposition. And I think that's quite a prevailing attitude outside of the work that I do, that relaxed performance is a compromise of artistic vision, which obviously makes artists a bit nervous about engaging in access work that's quite as intense as that. So what I do is I come in and go, okay, I know what you are trying to do with your show. I know the language to use to make you understand that I know what you're doing. Let's talk about affect. And let's talk about how we can make that affect accessible, aesthetic access, if you will. Say we've got a show that has a lot of lights and sound. What I will usually do if I've been brought on to fully relax that show is I will sit down with all the designers after the show has started up, and we will do a tech run where we go through every single program state. We talk about what it's trying to achieve. I talk about the ways that it can negatively affect an audience, and we alter it so that it will not affect an audience in an obsessively negative way, but will instead give a relative experience similar to the version that they had already arrived at, that is accessible to a wider range of people.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I can totally see why that is dramaturgy. That is great.
Yeah, you need to have an understanding of art and theatre in order to speak to the artist's intentions.
It would be a great test as an artist. And also to go, okay, so this is the effect I want to have. How do I do that with brains that don't work like mine?
Operate differently, we could say. One of the concrete examples I like to use is, now, I should also stress, this is my experience with relaxing. There are not really any scientific studies about the effects of specific theatrical techniques on various minds, which means this is, you know, a dramaturgy, but also an art at heart. It's not as physically defined as an Auslan performance or an audio described, because that is a specific craft that can be taught directly, whereas this one is still, you know, developing form.
Yeah.
So when you've got something like a snap to black, that can be disconcerting for a sensory sensitive audience, because what you're doing is changing the shape of the rune as it's being perceived. And a sudden change in the shape of a rune is disconcerting. So the simple way to do that is any snap to black is changed to a half second or a full second fade. Yeah. If you need to have a snap to black at all.
Yeah.
And that's where you get into the really technical and dramaturgically aesthetic discussion of, okay, what is this snap to black doing? Have you just put it in there because, oh, we need to change a setting and we don't want this to be seen? Does it serve as a punctuation within the scene? What are you doing with this? And can this same effect be achieved with a sensory-friendly alternative?
Yeah, brilliant. Now, I know you said that you worked on artworks, novels, theatre, etc., that featured neurodivergent characters. What do you think about artists who are neurotypical portraying the neurodivergent?
Ooh, okay. This is obviously there's a huge discussion around this. I think the question of casting is always political, and we cannot talk about total freedom within art, anyone being able to play anyone else without engaging in some delusion of equity across the land. Like, autistic artists, ADHD artists, neurodivergent artists have been historically disadvantaged from gaining access to the social realm in which these decisions are made. So there is a significant lack of autistic performers and ADHD performers and all those sort of performers in these scenes. Now, that being said, I do think that neurotypical actors can portray autistic characters. However, in the same way that any actor can portray any role, that is open to critique.
Yeah.
And it's open to much more severe critique because they are portraying a disadvantaged group. Like, I remember having a discussion with someone around a show that had been made to explore the life of what I perceived and a lot of the audience perceived to be an autistic character, but the creators of the show perceived to just be a precocious child. And I remember they had reached the point where they wanted to tour, and the touring bodies had said, you're going to need to put someone who is on the spectrum into this role. And they were torn about that because this role had been written for the actor that they had. We'd had consultation around that. They asked the question of, would it be all right to cast a neurotypical actor in this role? And I said, yes, so long as we can also cast white people in black roles. And they said, I don't think I agree with that. Then I said, then you're not doing representation. You're just making the representation be in a place that we can't see.
Right.
So when it's, I think I probably garbled that sentiment there, but basically.
No, I get exactly what you're saying. What do you think about it when novelists and writers write neurodivergent characters?
Well, I guess the logical endpoint of making it impermissible to write characters that you don't have direct experiences on is that you can only ever write solipsistic novels of your impression of other people's experiences. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to read novels where one person reflects on their own experience devoid of the world around them.
Yeah,
that sounds boring as hell and more like a manifesto. And as far as I can tell, manifestos only ever really get followed by violence. And no thank you to that. I think given the age that we live in and the idea of accuracy and correctness being forefront in artistic expression, people are available to be able to consult directly for specific characters and specific experiences. And again, it's a kind of dramaturgy. You're trying to ask the people, hey, does this character like float the boat? And I think a lot of people are scared if they go to the communities, they'll be told, no, you're representing this in a bad way. You got to take this away. And maybe there are people who would say that, but I think those people would say the same of any bad person who was not a out and out binarily obvious Disney villain of some sort. There's the fact of the matter is all lives are complicated, and yeah. all attempts to make them less complicated just make things more complicated, and that's what's really interesting about it. So personally, and I do realize me saying I think it is well worthwhile authors contact autistic people or people they wish to represent whose experience they have not researched to make sure that they haven't done anything completely untoward, given that that's a service that autistic offers. I'm unsure what the ethics of that are, but I do think it is in the best interest to make sure that at the very least you haven't gotten anything massively wrong.
So what makes for a good artistic consultation process in that world?
I would say the number one thing that will make for an effective consultation is that the consultant is directly in contact with the person with the most power to make decisions.
Yeah, that's great. That's such an important point.
Take recent example, music.
Yeah.
You get the very distinct impression that whoever they had on board doing consultation for that did not have direct access to the person who could make changes along the lines of the advice that was going to be given. Yeah. And that was raked through the mud for the general ineptitude that they approach the topic with. The other reason to connect them to someone with direct power, it shows you're serious about the consultation. It shows that, okay, I don't know what I'm doing with this, but here's a person we're giving money to tell us how to do it.
Yeah.
If they are not being brought up to the top at the very start, you're presenting them as,
yeah.
I consider doing due diligence to understand what experience it is that I am trying to aesthetically profit from as beneath me. How could an audience come along to a piece like that and go, yes, that creative is someone who cares about my life in a manner sufficient for me to take part in this narrative that they want to tell me?
Yeah. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I think it's great that you frame how positive that consultancy can be, because I agree with you. Sometimes you are going to have a work that's going to only be written by one person, and they might be a person who lives with disability or a person of colour, but they also might want to have a broad spectrum of writers in there. And I think we need to figure out how to make that possible and respectful. So I think that's a really excellent point. It's been brilliant to chat to you today, Tom. Thank you so much.
Oh, my goodness. It's gone so fast. Wow.
So fast.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Welcome back to Activated Arts on 2RPH. We're now joined by Matthew Field. Matt is the CEO of Attitude Foundation, and he has a long history of working in the community media sector. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Anthea. Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Attitude Foundation and your work there?
Yeah, absolutely. Love to. So the foundation was started by Graham Innes, who had just retired his role with the Human Rights Commission. I think Graham saw the need in Australia to start a foundation that was really focused on the issue of attitudes towards people with disability and to address what he described as the tyranny of low expectations that that some people hold within the community towards people with disability. And so it was Graham's view that the media has a powerful role to play in shaping and forming those attitudes. So media was the vehicle, the conduit that was determined as being the kind of the best approach to getting to the broader community and addressing some of those problematic attitudes that the community holds. So it was started in 2014 with some support from the corporate sector. The organisation was funded to produce a documentary series, which is called Perspective Shift. So Perspective Shift really focused on the three half-hour documentary series that focused on people with disability working in the arts sector. So we had three arts practitioners with disability: Prue Stevenson, who's a visual artist, Yana Castillo, a dancer, and I've forgotten his name.
Daniel Monks.
Daniel Monks, sorry, who's an actor. Yeah, so the idea behind the series was to really ensure that the entire production from Woe to Go employed a best practice approach to inclusion. So we ensured we had people with disability working at all stages of the production, from, you know, pre-production, casting, scripting, through to the actual shoots themselves and the editing process, as well as ensuring that the participants, you know, were able to speak in their own voices and told their own stories. So in that way, the idea was to produce content that would be appealing to the broader community, to really sort of challenge some of the prevailing views around disability out there in the community, but also to provide for the broader media sector a best practice approach to content creation, in terms of, you know, behind the scenes inclusion, but also, you know, portraying realistic and authentic characters as they are, and not relying on some of these typical stereotypes that exist in the media more broadly. So, yeah, so that was the sort of the genesis of the organisation. And I joined about a year and a half ago with a background in community media. Yeah, and now we're really looking to sort of take the next step with the organisation and to broaden our reach and to increase the sort of the amount of content that we're making, etc.
Perspective Shift is a really beautiful series. I absolutely loved watching it. And it is so clear that each artist is getting to speak in their own voice about their stories. And they're some really remarkable stories as well. And it's also lovely that you see some of the family members and other artists around those individuals and some of the change and understanding that they've been through as well. It's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. I also noticed on your website you had guidelines for the media when portraying people with disabilities. What would you like to see change in the media?
Yeah, I think probably the most problematic, you know, are some of the tropes and stereotypes that exist. And I think it's really important to frame this around that this is not these are well-meaning in their intent, but they're tropes that really hold people with disability back. And the most common trope that you see in the media is the inspirational trope. So the person with disability overcoming their disability, heroically, you know, overcoming their impairment and taking their place in the community. Now, that's a well-meaning idea, but it's a really damaging stereotype, because the reality is, and the story that we're trying to convey is that, you know, is that a person's impairment is their personal journey. Yeah. Everyone has their issues, and whether they be an impairment or whatever it might be, but they aren't necessarily holding us back from, or shouldn't hold us back from, participating in society, and that actually many people with disability live with that disability, they cope with it, or they, you know, they do what they need to do, but ultimately it's the role of society to bridge the gap between where they are and to allow them to fully participate. So we're really trying to address that. The other common one is pity, where, you know, we see a person with disability as being afflicted, and, again, that doesn't necessarily always hold true, you know, within the community. So by creating media that tells these stories in the own words of the participants, we can really kind of convey this idea that, you know, disability is really just another dimension of diversity. And if we look at it in that way, if we don't look at it as a story of inspiration or a story of pity, we just see it as the full spectrum of human, that the human existence and the human experience many times includes an impairment or a disability. Sometimes we can see that, sometimes we can't, sometimes people are born with it and sometimes they acquire it. And so really the Beatitude Foundation is concerned with developing, you know, content that that tells that story. But, yeah, so we have resources on our website for the broader media sector to really kind of assist them to, you know, understand that these well-meaning tropes are actually hugely problematic.
Do you do consultancy when people are looking to portray people with disability and maybe they are writers who don't have that disability?
Yeah, we do. We've just started doing a little bit of that work. Now that we have a body of work behind us, I think it's helpful for producers of content and broadcasters to know that, you know, we are producers of content ourselves, and we, many of us within the organisation, have a background in broadcasting. So we understand the sector, we understand the challenges, and we understand the environment, the broadcasting and production environment. So we're we're able to provide that support from a position of experience. And yeah, so we are, we have started to do a little bit of work with some content producers. Probably won't name them just yet, but and what I'm seeing really that, you know, increasingly there's a desire within the media sector, particularly within the national broadcasters, to ingrain better practice within their commissioning, within their production, and within how they, you know, schedule, and ensuring that there's a greater representation of people with disability in roles that aren't necessarily related to disability.
Yeah. It's been lovely to see that. It's been lovely to see, you know, sometimes we're going to cast a high school girl chatting about boys, and we're just going to cast someone who happens to have a disability because high school girls chat about boys with disability or without.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really empowering for people with disability to see.
Well, Matt, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. Thanks, Anthea.
Now we're up to our What's On with brilliant Hannah Cormack. Hannah, what are you seeing and not seeing this month?
This month I actually had the chance to wander around in a gallery space. Amazing. But it was an online 360-degree virtual tour that's at the Footscray Arts Prize. And the work that I really wanted to highlight there is by Rihanna Head-Toussaint, and it's her video work First Language, which kind of looks at the inherent movement language she's developed as a wheelchair user. It's a video work that has a straight format as well as an audio description format, and you can view that either in person at the Footscray Art Prize exhibition, which is at the Footscray Community Arts Centre, or online at footscrayartprize.com. Full disclosure, I was involved in the original commissioning of this work, First Language, for the iDance Festival, but it was really enjoyable to revisit it in this setting of wandering through the virtual gallery. And the great thing about being able to wander around in the exhibition meant that I stumbled across other works as well, such as Audist College by another amazing deaf artist, Shel DiStefano. So I really do recommend popping in either virtually or in person to view both of these incredible works.
Awesome. I've so been enjoying seeing these virtual galleries that you've recommended. It's really been exciting. And what is it that you are not seeing?
Rising Festival is hosting a retrospective of works from back to back, including Small Metal Objects, which I've always wanted to see. That's going to be on at Queensbridge Square, May 29 to June 1st. Now, Anthea, you've actually seen this one yourself, haven't you?
It's remarkable. I love Back to Back. They were on a couple of months ago. I think they're a fabulous theatre company.
Now, I know that this work has hearing augmentation supplied through a headset as part of the work, and I don't know if there are provisions for deaf audience or not, or if captions or Auslan interpretation is available. I'm also not sure if AD is available or not, but hopefully that information can be made available on the Rising website.
That's such a pity that that's not accessible. The Rising Festival looks so remarkable. I was hoping I was going to see some of it even from Sydney, but is that not going to be possible?
Not that I've been able to gather from the website so far, and it's a pretty exciting website, I must say. I did enjoy being able to scroll through and find the information quite clearly in general, but I didn't come across any information that indicated there would be any kind of live stream or remote viewing options.
That's a pity. So what else is happening?
What we do have coming up is Arts Activated 2021, and the theme for this year is Building Back Better. So it's going to be a hybrid live and online event. Some aspects will be live, some will be online, and some will be both. And that's happening on August 9, 16, and 23.
Awesome. I think some of our shows coming up are going to tie in with that festival as well. So more for that coming up for our audience. Thanks so much for joining me, Hannah.
Thanks, Anthea.
See you next month.